It's 9 o'clock. It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use, and we'll start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, is going to be having a restoration this Saturday, October 9th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Natural Bridges State Park. We will be continuing our work on ice plant eradication on the dunes. It is fall migration time for many bird species, and this park is an excellent spot to see many known and unknown species, so bring a pair of binoculars if you have them. How to get there? Well, basically, go to the west end of West Cliff Drive, park on the street rather than in the parking lot, and they will meet at the sand parking lot just inside past the fee kiosk. Okay, that's not the parking lot to the left. It's the one past the fee kiosk. Okay? In other words, as you head up toward the picnic ground, it'll be the first parking lot on the left before you go down the hill. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. They'll probably get mostly shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. For more information, the contact person is Linda. Her number is 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. You could also send her an email at redwoodrn, that's redwoodrn at packbell.net, or visit their webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. Those folks have a lot of fun out there doing that. It's a really great thing they do, cleaning up all the mess that all those invasive plants cause in our public parks. Here's the Buffalo Field campaign update from the field. Unfortunately, I didn't make it to the Buffalo Field campaign tour stop last Saturday. I don't know what happened. I had something else going on that day, and I guess it just escaped my mind. But anyway, I guess I didn't see you there. On Tuesday, October 5th, the National Park Service announced that Daniel Wenck will replace Suzanne Lewis as superintendent of Yellowstone National Park starting next year. Buffalo Field Campaign are hopeful that this change will bring more bison-friendly policies to Yellowstone National Park. It's difficult to imagine a superintendent doing more harm to wild bison than Lewis, who directed park rangers to kill or send to slaughter more than 2,600 wild bison during her 8-year tenure. Wenck, who has a background in landscape architecture, will move to Yellowstone from Washington, D.C., where he is currently working as Deputy Director of Operations with the Park Service. Other changes are afoot as well, with the Buffalo Field Campaign's Fall Roadshow wrapping up in Santa Barbara tonight, and volunteers old and new making plans to join us in West Yellowstone for the start of field patrols in mid-November. The days are growing shorter and the nights are starting to hint of winter, when the buffalo will follow their hearts and hunger from Yellowstone's high country into Montana. This will be the Buffalo Field Campaign's 14th season in the field, monitoring the migration, protecting the bison, and sharing their story with the world. The arrival of winter days always feels like both a blessing and a curse, as the joys of having buffalo back on the landscape are tempered by the knowledge of the fate that awaits them in Montana. While field patrols will always play a central role in the work of the Buffalo Field Campaign, we will continue to put a great deal of energy into grassroots advocacy, organizing, and policy work. As you read in last week's update, our legal team is continuing to do everything in our power to change the policies and hold the Park Service, Forest Service, and State of Montana accountable to their own laws. BFC will spend time in both Helena and Washington, D.C. this winter to advocate for bison protection. As always, we will keep you up to date on every action against the buffalo and let you know when letters, public comments, and other actions are needed. Wanting deeper involvement? Volunteer in the field this winter at Buffalo Field's campaign headquarters near West Yellowstone, Montana. Volunteers are needed from November 15th to June 1st. Thank you for keeping us strong with your support. We are in this together, and there would be no Buffalo Field campaign without you. If you'd like to become a Buffalo Field campaign volunteer, the very first thing you should do is go to their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and read everything there is there to find out what a volunteer does, the conditions in which they do it, and the requirements and the rules and regulations that go along with being a volunteer. I'm not saying it's onerous. I'm just saying that being a Buffalo Field campaign volunteer is not for everybody. The weather in Montana can get particularly harsh in the wintertime. It would be a great thing if you had all your own equipment, which means lots and lots of warm clothing. Nothing cotton. Okay. Wool and polyester and water weatherproof nylon, Gore-Tex. That's the kind of stuff that's going to keep you warm in the 20 and 30 degree below temperatures in Montana in the wintertime. There are lots of other things involved with being a Buffalo Field campaign volunteer. So go to the website, check it out, make sure that's what you want to do, and then fill out the application and send it in. They need to get an application from you before you go there. They really need to approve people. It's not a real onerous thing, but they certainly want to take a look at who is volunteering to help them before they arrive. And, of course, once you arrive, there will be a significant amount of training that goes on a couple of weeks' worth. So they actually ask that you make a 4 to 6 week commitment. If you can only stay 3 weeks, that's great. If you can't stay 3 weeks, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do 2 weeks of training and then have 1 week in the field. It doesn't help them out very much. Unless, of course, you want to be a cook or something like that and help out in the kitchen. Or if you're a vehicle mechanic and you can repair vehicles in 20 degree below zero temperatures, they need that. But I'm going on a little bit here. But they're asking for volunteers, so see if it's something you want to do. It's really helpful if you can cross-country ski, but if you can't, they also have snowshoes available for their volunteers. It's very beautiful and very cold in Montana in the wintertime. Anyway, if you would like to support the Buffalo Field Campaign with a donation, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions and you want to talk to somebody directly, their phone number is 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And, of course, the webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And we've been waiting for this for a long time. I'm not sure it's good news, but some news is better than no news, I guess. Scientists and soldiers solve the bee mystery, they think, in this story by Kirk Johnson of the New York Times. Now a unique partnership of military scientists and entomologists appears to have achieved a major breakthrough and identified a new suspect or two. A fungus tag teaming with a virus have apparently interacted to cause the problem, according to a paper by Army scientists in Maryland and bee experts in Montana in the online science journal PLOS-1. Exactly how that combination kills bees remains uncertain, the scientists say, and it's the subject for the next round of research. But there are some definitely solid clues. This is what's been causing the bee colony problem called colony collapse disorder. Endovirus, and this is the actual abstract from the paper. I certainly can't read you the whole paper, but we get enough information in the abstract to be able to help you out. And, of course, if you want more information, you could go to the Science Journal PLOS1. I think you have to subscribe to get beyond the abstract, but if you're really interested, that's where to go. Endovirus and microsporidian linked to honeybee colony decline. Here's the background. In 2010, colony collapse disorder, or CCD, again devastated honeybee colonies in the United States and Europe, indicating that the problem is neither diminishing nor has it been resolved. Many CCD investigations using sensitive genome-based methods have found small RNA B viruses and the microsporidia Nosema apis and Nosema serenea in healthy and collapsing colonies alike, with no single pathogen firmly linked to honeybee losses. This study used mass spectrometry-based proteomics to identify and quantify thousands of proteins from healthy and collapsing bee colonies. The technique revealed two unreported RNA viruses in North American honeybees, Varroa destructor 1 virus and Kakugu virus, and identified an invertebrate iridescent virus, Iroviridae, associated with colony collapse disorders. Prevalence of IIV significantly discriminated among strong, failing, and collapsed colonies. In other words, if the iridovirus was found, the colonies were definitely collapsing. In addition, bees in failing colonies contain not only the iridovirus, but also the Nosema viruses. Co-occurrence of these microbes consistently marked CCD in bees from commercial apiaries sampled across the U.S. in 2006 and 7. Bees sequentially sampled as the disorder progressed in an observation hive colony in 2008. And 3 bees from a recurrence of CCD in Florida in 2009. The pathogen pairing was not observed in samples from colonies with no history of CCD, namely bees from Australia and a large non-migratory beekeeping business in Montana. Laboratory cage trials with a strain of the iridovirus type 6 and Nosema serenae confirmed that co-infection with these two pathogens was more lethal to bees than either pathogen alone. In conclusion, these findings implicate co-infection with iridoviruses and Nosema with honeybee colony declines, giving credence to older research pointing to that virus interacting with Nosema and mites as probable cause of bee losses in the United States, Europe, and Asia. The next thing we need to do is characterize the iridovirus and Nosema that we detected and develop management practices and perhaps vaccines to reduce honeybee losses. So they're making progress on solving the bee problem. And it's time for the forestry update for September. This forestry update is prepared monthly by Jody Frediani of the Sierra Club Forestry Task Force, and she is a forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz group of the Ventana chapter of the Sierra Club. And our first piece of news is Semper Virens Fund has purchased the Lago Marcino old growth redwoods. As we reported last week, Semper Virens has closed escrow on the 35-acre Lago Marcino property in San Mateo County. This is a huge victory. This property has 13 acres of old-growth redwood, 63 very large old trees, with two or three clustered on 10 acres, and the remaining large trees scattered throughout. That's two-thirds, I guess. A timber harvest plan prepared by Roy Webster was approved by Cal Fire in May, the same day that Department of Fish and Game submitted an 11-page memorandum explaining their non-concurrence. The victory was a multi-pronged effort. Department of Fish and Game continued to find fault with the plan from the get-go. The Department of Fish and Game findings memo explains in detail their concerns, but earlier during plan review, DFG suggested that a conservation easement be put on the old growth. During plan review, I alerted the Center for Biological Diversity. They, in turn, submitted some excellent letters challenging the timber harvest plan. Sierra Club and Central Coast Forest Watch submitted extensive comments. Also, I alerted the Committee for Green Foothills, who contacted the Mid-Peninsula Open Space District, which also submitted comments of concern. Semper Virens Fund was notified of the threat to old growth and was able to begin negotiations with the landowners. Mid-Peninsula Open Space District expressed interest in ultimate acquisition of the property, and now that Semper Virens was able to successfully negotiate the purchase, MidPen will take ultimate possession, and all that, of course, depends on when the money gets shuffled around. The National Marine Fisheries Service gets a large wood agreement from the Soquel Demonstration State Forest. Another victory is near at hand, hopefully on September 22nd. Another heavily attended site visit was held on the Soquel Demonstration State Forest. This one was not part of the Fern Gulch THP, but was rather organized by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Something like 19 people attended, including folks from Cal Fire, Department of Fish and Game, the California Geologic Survey, and Santa Cruz County Resource Conservation District, the County Environmental Planner, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Folks present from Cal Fire included Cal Fire's Chief Deputy Director Crawford Tuttle, the Deputy Director of Resource Management from Sacramento, Bill Snyder, one of the two heads of the State Forestry Program, Russ Henley, Acting SDSF Manager Rich Sampson, and Assistant SDSF Manager Ed Ori, and Cal Fire's Hydrologist Pete Caffarata. That's some pretty big guns, so I'm hoping they were paying close attention and that other attendees understood their presence, that this is an important business. National Marine Fisheries Service has been eager to see large wood installed in Soquel Creek as a demonstration project for some time. In April of this year, National Marine Fisheries Service sent a letter to the forest requesting Cal Fire do a large wood installation demo project in Soquel Creek along the demonstration forest. As readers of this newsletter and newscast are well aware, large woody debris or large woody management, I hate the word debris, provides needed habitat for coho and steelhead and improves stream conditions in a variety of ways, from helping to scour pools to providing shelter for fish. National Marine Fisheries Service has continued to urge SDSF to undertake such a demonstration project, which fits nicely with the intent of the legislature under AB 1965, the legislation that established the state forest. Section 4660 of the PRC states that it is the intent of the legislature in establishing the Soquel Demonstration State Forest to provide an environment that will do the following: provide watershed protection for local communities and baseline monitoring and studies of the hazards, risks, and benefits of forest operations and watersheds to urban areas, unquote. During the site visit, the various fisheries biologists and geologists discussed possible locations and willingness to participate in future discussions of where and how to place large wood. The Resource Conservation District expressed willingness to assist in obtaining the needed permits through an expedited process and asked that a team from Cal Fire be created to work with them. Bill Snyder agreed to designate a team that will likely be led by Pete Caffarata to work with the Resource Conservation District, the California Geological Survey, and the Department of Fish and Game. Resource Conservation District believes they can get the necessary permits within 6 months, so installation could be possible as early as next year. Of course, a key outstanding issue to be resolved is where the funding for such a project would come from. And in the RIM timber sale, the notice of timber sale has gone out. The state of California must accept bids for timber harvest on state-owned lands. The timber sale for the 158-acre RIM THP on the Soquel Demonstration State Forest is accepting bids for approximately 1,826 million board feet of timber, and that sale is open until 1:30 on October 11th. That's coming up on Monday, sounds like. The minimum bid rate per 1,000 board feet is $355. The fixed price for Douglas fir is $20 per 1,000 board feet. There's 3.3 million board feet of that available. I wish someone could calculate the value of standing Douglas fir in a forest for wildlife, habitat, watershed protection, aesthetics, old growth, recruitment, carbon sequestration, etc. Well, folks, we're talking about $66 for a Doug fir to be harvested from the rim THP. Doesn't make sense to anyone to cut down the Doug fir at that price. I can only imagine there is some twisted thought that it must be removed as a weed so that more redwoods can thrive. It's got to cost more than that to log those trees. Estimated value for the whole sale is $647,231. Let's see, with that income, they could repair the failing access road, install the large woody debris that National Marine Fisheries Service wants in the creek, and maybe put in a permanent bridge or something like that. A one-day pre-bid field trip was held on September 23rd. Winter operations are not allowed, so logging might commence next spring. And the Sierra Club has sued Cal Fire and the Bohemian Club. Here are a few tasty excerpts from a reply brief the Sierra Club and Save the Bohemian Grove attorney Paul Carroll. Refusing, and I'm quoting now from the brief, refusing to concede error, California Fire and the Bohemian Club are forced to create ever more bizarre arguments in defense of the non-industrial timber management plan. No California agency has tried as hard to avoid CEQA's mandates, and none has lost as many times in courts of appeal. Indeed, in virtually every published decision in which Cal Fire has resisted compliance with CEQA, it has lost. Recently, the First District Court of Appeal took Cal Fire to task for its specious reasoning in trying to evade CEQA's mandate that significant new information about a project requires recirculation for public comment. Nevertheless, California Department of Forestry has continued to resist complying with CEQA by advancing increasingly contorted interpretations of settled law. We urge the California Department of Forestry to heed the law as consistently interpreted by the courts of this state and to commit its time and resources towards the more productive end of conforming its process to comply with the California Environmental Quality Act. And the Columbus Day logging proposed rule change. In 1982, when the state took away local control of logging and gave it to Cal Fire, they threw a bone to the counties. Counties can propose rules for local needs, and the Board of Forestry can adopt them if they deem the rules necessary. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. At any rate, two such rules exist for Santa Cruz, San Mateo, Marin, Lake, and Monterey counties, prohibiting logging on log hauling on national holidays. Of course, there is always the wiggle room language, which says that if the director deems it won't be a problem when logging and hauling can occur on such days. Apparently, local foresters routinely request for permission to conduct timber operations on Columbus Day, because it comes close to the end of the season prior to the winter period, and they routinely get granted the exception. Since most plans have winter operations, I'm not sure why this is needed. Apparently, 95% of all approved harvesting plans in the counties of Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, and San Mateo include an allowance for operations and hauling on Columbus Day. The unanswered question is, how many of those plans actually complete harvesting prior to the onset of the winter period? At any rate, now Central Coast foresters are contending that it is too much paperwork and cost to have to submit a request and have it approved so they can conduct operations on Columbus Day. Since it's not a state holiday, they feel logging should be allowed as a de facto. Not sure I have a problem with Columbus Day logging, but I am concerned that this proposed rule has been discussed in committee at the Board of Forestry and may be moving forward to a full board hearing and vote, yet the affected counties have not even been notified of the proposed change. It seems that at a minimum, it would be a courtesy to let the local governments be that requested the limitation rule in the first place participate in the committee level if they so choose. Now it turns out that this proposal also includes an alternative that would allow logging on almost all holidays not observed by the state of California. Does that mean if Montana has a holiday on Saturday, then our locals can log on that day? Who can designate these holidays? This year, the feds have declared December 24th a holiday because Christmas falls on a Saturday. Under this alternative, logging could occur on similar national holidays without an exception needed to be granted. Of course, if adopted, this rule will not go into effect until next year. Of more importance is how counties are notified of proposed changes to county special rules. Can the Board of Forestry make such changes without having them being proposed by the counties themselves? If so, shouldn't they notify the counties up front so they can participate prior to full messaging? Full massaging, of course, is what it says here, of the proposed rule in committee. Hoping to have some answers soon and get a Santa Cruz County to communicate their concerns to the Board of Forestry. And a new hatchery manager for the Kingfisher Flat Hatchery at Scott Creek has been named. The Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout Project hired interim hatchery manager on September 13th after Carla Moss, the previous hatchery manager, resigned. The new hatchery manager is Russell Enriquez, a graduate of Humboldt State with a degree in biology. He has experience in fish culture and trapping Chinook salmon while working for the California Department of Fish and Game. The leadership of the Monterey Bay Salmon Trout Project is also undergoing change. Al Smith is about to retire, and Matt Rowley and Bob Anderson are taking over as co-chairman of the Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout Project. The Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout Project is a, quote, non-profit environmental organization dedicated to the restoration, conservation, and enhancement of native wild coho salmon and steelhead populations and their coastal and marine habitats from San Mateo to the South Monterey Bay. They run the Kingfisher Flat Hatchery. Interestingly, to use the website and see their newsletter, you need to sign up to become a member and log in first. For years, much of their funding has come from the Department of Fish and Game. The Santa Cruz County Fish and Game Advisory Commission has also funded projects of the Monterey Bay Salmon Trout Project for a number of years. I would think such a publicly funded nonprofit would make its business more publicly accessible. And clear-cutting for carbon credits under the Climate Action Reserve's forest protocols. In the "this isn't really happening" category, a number of groups, including Sierra Club California and EPFW, with the assistance from the Center for Biological Diversity, have continued to attempt to get clear-cutting removed from the Climate Action Reserve's forest protocol as an acceptable logging method for receiving carbon credits under California's Law AB 32. Needless to say, the industry is throwing their weight around to great effect to keep clear-cuts in the carbon credit mix. Here are some of the issues outlined in a recent letter signed by concerned groups and sent to the California Air Resources Board and the Climate Action Reserve. Under the Climate Action Reserve's forest protocol, forest clear-cutting and other even-aged management practices that degrade forest ecosystems and wildlife habitat can qualify as carbon offset projects. Forest offset projects that may include timber operations that convert a native forest to even-aged plantations. Forest offset projects may clear-cut an entire watershed on a 50-year rotation with 40-acre clear-cuts implemented at 5-year intervals. Forest offset projects may claim carbon credits for the growth of trees regenerating after forest clear-cutting that occurred at least 10 years prior. Many forest projects do not have to account for losses from the understory, litter and soil, and deadwood carbon pools. Many forest projects do not have to account for losses of lying deadwood, which can be both a significant carbon pool and a critical component of wildlife habitat, and forest offset projects are not prohibited from shifting timber harvesting to elsewhere in their timber operations and are not even required to report such leakage. And Sierra Pacific Industries owner is on the Forbes list. Of the top 10 private landowners in the United States, more than half are in it for the money. Coming in right behind Ted Turner, for example, is billionaire Archie, or also known as Red Emerson, a one-time sawmill operator who has amassed 1.9 million acres of timberland in California and Washington. Emerson's family-owned Sierra Pacific Industries has a $1 billion a year business, not a weekend indulgence, and Sierra Pacific Industries continues to clear-cut their major land holdings and turn them into large developments if they can get away with it. And we want to thank Jody Frediani for her monthly forest updates. Jody Frediani is a forestry consultant for the Forestry Task Force of the Santa Cruz Group of the Ventana Chapter of the Sierra Club. And we thank her for her diligent, hard work month after month after month. Well, that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to download a podcast or listen to a previous Earth First Update, that's pretty easy to do. All you have to do is go to www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we want to thank the folks at the h2opodcast.com site for recording and archiving those shows for our listeners. And they've been doing a really good job of that. Really like it. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Earth First Update is broadcast every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Please tune in, and we thank you for listening.